Good afternoon and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson and you're listening to WDRT Community Radio coming from Viroqua in the Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin. 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can listen to this show in a few days and many, many shows that are on our archives, both for Who's in the Kitchen and for our farming show, Digging Deep. We air at noon on every Saturday and have been doing so for 14 or more years now. So welcome to the show. I have a guest that I've never spoken to before from Norwegian Hollow Hideaway, southwest, I guess it's west of Viroqua, right? West of Viroqua out on off of Highway 56. Anthony Horner. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, good morning.
And you are the chef owner.
Yes, this is correct.
I asked for that and I got you. And people have been down to the Hideaway. I mean, the Hideaway's been around for a long time. And it's been kind of a place, you know, people find it. A lot of motorcyclists find it. It's kind of a, you know, a little destination to go to. But I've kind of heard that, you know, it's... that you are making a mark on that restaurant in your own individual way. And I was just really interested in talking to you about it. And so I guess I want to know if you have been around here for a long time or are you newcomer to the Driftless?
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll get started here. I grew up in Prairie du Chien.
Oh, really?
So yes, Wisconsin native. And I'd been living outside of Gay's Mills for a while, but seasonally, because working as a traveling private chef in the meantime. So I was looking for, basically after about 8 years, trying to lock down something closer to home, closer to my roots, looking for a project, and I came across Norwegian Hollow Hideaway.
Wow, it's a spectacular location, isn't it? Just, you know, in a beautiful scenic part of our county.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, right.
So the establishment started actually in 2006. So I am like now the basically third owner of the place, right? So it went back and forth in the family and then to one other, and then now it's on to me. So what I'm trying to do is kind of honor the traditions that started there, right? And being a idyllic little bar and grill outside of town. And trying to sort of just refine the concept, you know, take what they had already been building over these many years putting my mark on it, you know, being a trained chef. Like, I went to culinary school in France, so I do have a little bit of a culinary background here. So I'm not trying to change the menu too much, but what's happened over the past 6 to 8 months is that I've been able to kind of refine the menu just a little bit. And get a few different specials that people hadn't seen before, and just being a little bit more creative with it.
I think that's a great way to go. Don't just change it all up at once. Something's working there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why people go there in the first place. And really, a little bar and grill, I mean, I'm thinking, how many are there anymore? I mean, that's really, you know, kind of a little destination for people who want to go out and have that experience. And what would you say was typically the bar and grill offering as far as food and atmosphere?
Typically, I mean, people know it as a really good spot to go for your burgers, wings, and pizza, that kind of stuff. You can go over there with larger groups because there's a lot of parking out there, and it's kind of being outside of town. You've got a bit of acreage to kind of look over, and it's a really nice ambience out there.
Do you have some outside seating?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's outside seating, 4 large tables out on a deck. A lot of folks kind of milling about out there. This summer, we're starting up a volleyball program. So there's an outdoor area in the back. It's got volleyball nets, and there's a little outdoor bar. So I'm looking forward to putting that to good use this summer.
Oh, well, that sounds great. We're going to just... Yeah, I want to talk about, you know, what's kind of formed you, and I'm certainly interested in being a traveling chef. That sounds pretty interesting. When did you start getting interested in cooking? It sounds like probably pretty early if you went to cooking school. I mean, you already knew you wanted to cook, right? Pretty early?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of positive experiences cooking, you know, watching my mom cook. I mean, my grandma taught me how to make bread. So that was kind of fun when I was, like, working at a bakery over in France. And I was like, well, the first loaves I made, you know, were just very standard bread loaves, right? And then you just take it, kind of the next level. We were doing like puff pastry and stuff like that. It was kind of fun. But I could really attribute my experience in learning to love cooking probably in my college days.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working at an organic cafe on campus at University of Stevens Point.
Okay.
So that was my first or second restaurant job. First was actually as a dishwasher. I did start as a dishwasher. Prairie du Chien, Huckleberries, thanks so much, Huckleberries, for giving me a job. That was my start. You know, it was first ever hourly job working as a dishwasher, you know.
That's where a lot of kids start. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning. And then you find out if you like being in a restaurant, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Where did France come in? When did you go to France?
So that would have been after I graduated from University of Stevens Point. I was obviously needing a job. I mean, the degree I hold is not very high paying. I have a degree in philosophy with a minor in arts, music minor and French language.
French!
So it doesn't exactly pay the bills straight away. So I was looking for a job, of course. Got one in the kitchen. I was working with Chef Christian Sherwanka up in Stevens Point. Working at Christian's Bistro. That restaurant's not there anymore, but there are other restaurants in Stevens Point that he owns. He's doing a great job still after all these years. So I decided it was basically, I had a career opportunity there. I could have kind of worked my way up, and I'm sure it would have been very rewarding as well. But I thought I could potentially kickstart a career in culinary if maybe I went and got some formal training. So I had studied French, of course, in college, so I already had a good grasp of the language. So I signed myself up for a 3-month intensive program followed by an internship that was all taking place in France. The school was in the south of France, in Cap d'Agde, and then they put me in the internship, was outside of Lyon. So it was a 5-star hotel, very, very nice spot, and that my time as an intern was definitely rewarding, but something I would, at this point in my career, never go back to.
Why is that?
In France, it's very common. The interns are practically free labor, so we get a little stipend and some housing, you know, but it was split shifts every day, you know, and that was very typical for them, right? They didn't have a morning cook or a night cook. Everyone would go in, do the prep, what you needed to do for the lunch service, little break, and then come back for the evening. So it was pretty intense, you know.
I would think.
We worked in a nice kitchen, but it was still very strict hierarchy, very much the brigade system, French brigade system, you know.
Can you describe that a little bit? You got a head chef and then you got workers. Is that what you mean?
Kind of. I mean,
what's a brigade system?
Basically, it was Escoffier back in the 1800s. He's a pretty well-known French chef. He basically instated an order of a hierarchy in the kitchen. So every station is going to have its chef, would be a chef de partie, and then under them they have the commis, and then under that there would be like porters and stuff, and then above the chef de partie you would have a sous chef, maybe an executive sous chef, head chef, and then maybe you'd have, like at this restaurant we had like, we called him like the chef d'honneur. He was just like the long-term, really culinary master of that establishment, you know. Mm-hmm. So the ranking system makes it such that you can sort of organize your station in a way that's efficient for service.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a hierarchy there to follow commands. He set it up like the military, Escoffier did back in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And that's, when you think of a French kitchen, that's very typical.
Mm-hmm. So you're not creative. Your chef and your sous chef, they're the creative ones. They're the ones who create the menu. They just tell you what to do.
Yeah, right. Once you're in a commis position, you're definitely like, you just working on your cuts, how to dice an onion, make sure everything is very precise for your mise en place, which is getting everything ready for the meal and service. And yeah, life is a lot simpler when you're a commie. You're just able to, you know, you're just a grunt and you could just say, yes, chef. You know, you say, oui, chef. And then do your job, do it right, and you're going to have a good life.
Right, right.
You know, and then when you add the creative element into there, then there's these expectations that you do see innovation in the kitchen and you do, or if it's something where you're going to uphold the standards, right? So there's some of these longstanding restaurants, you wouldn't change the recipe if your life depended on it, right?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, you earn these stars, these Michelin stars, and you have to produce. I mean, when somebody goes to a restaurant that's been rated highly, you're going because they have a reputation and they do it right and they do it well every time. And so it is really important. Everybody is, you know, right at their stations and doing what they're told to do, right? And produce mm-hmm. produce the dishes that they're famous for. They deserve it. So what was this, were you at a school or a restaurant, or is it both?
This was both. The program is different. It's still going on today. Anyone inspired, go to Gastronomicom Culinary School. It's their equivalent of like a technical college.
Mm-hmm.
So you go there, you'll take French language lessons, and then either direct into culinary, or like a savory, or pastry. I was already speaking French at the time, so I didn't take the French. Was doing pastry and savory at the time, which was great. So because
yeah,
I
wow.
like to do both, and working as a private chef, I was able to do both. I really needed to do both, right? Because the dessert is quite important. It's the last thing that the guests are going to remember you by, that kind of thing. So the school itself was in Agde. It's the very south of France, near Montpellier.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hotel was up near Lyon.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Beau Rivage.
Le Beau Rivage.
That's great. And they're mm-hmm. still on it. They have a new chef there who was working his way in when I was on the way out. And they have definitely refined that concept too. They're doing some really awesome stuff.
Cool. Maybe we can talk about that too. So after culinary school, then what was your next step?
So then again, I was still kind of looking to see what I wanted to do. Obviously, I was going to still keep traveling, keep cooking. Those were my main goals at that time. So then I remembered when I was finishing up the internship, really didn't know exactly how to go about this, but I knew deep down, I knew basically cooking skills are valuable all over the world. As long as you know, it's one trade that has directly transferable skills. Like I could get a job in some kitchen anywhere. Even if I was like peddling crepes on the side of the road, like I would still be traveling and cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But I remembered I had spoken with a fellow student that at Gastronomicom, saying, "Oh, she's just taking a break from her main job." I said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, that's working as a yacht chef." I thought, well, maybe I could work on these yachts, you know?
It sounds like a dream.
Right, so then I packed all my stuff up at the end of internship, took a ride share all the way down to the south of France again. So then I was back there, and that's where all the super yacht ports are. So basically, there's a certification you get and to be a seafarer. It's a basic seafarer certification and also a health certificate. And after that is technically the only qualifications you need to work on a yacht. I thought, well, that's great. I'm going to go give it a shot. So I did. I stayed at a little hostel and, you know, met other crew, like, looking for work. You would go down to the docks and try to, like, meet a captain or meet, you know, someone to try to get a job on a yacht. So in networking down there, this is in Antibes. I was down there staying in a hostel, had about maybe 2 or 3 weeks of a job search, and that's when it hit, where they said, yes, we need a chef. We need one in Greece, and we need a chef in the next, like, 3 days. Can you make it to Greece? I was like, well, sure, yes. So I went and, flew over down to Rhodos and then joined my first yacht over in Greece.
Now, would that be, like, I mean, is that, like, a reliable job, or is it really very seasonal, or what? I mean, you know, like, 3 weeks or 6 months or year on for good? Or how does that work?
It varies program by program. Mm. There are a lot of long-term stable positions in the field. But generally speaking, it's very geared towards more freelance, especially in the chef aspect. A lot of freelance chefs because the job is quite demanding. So if you see someone has maybe 3 years on their CV, that's pretty amazing in that field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where if you see 3 months, you're like, that's solid. That's they got through the whole season. You're looking pretty solid that, you know, you'd be able to make it mm-hmm. through a Mediterranean season or a Caribbean season
mm-hmm.
Successfully.
So what are the special challenges of working on a you know, a seafaring vessel?
Working on
have a very tight... Do you have a decent kitchen, or is it really tight, small space? And then, of course, I guess you've got motion, and, you know, you learn about things that are... And you've got limited amount of supplies. You have to get your supplies. You tell me.
Sure. No, you're right on the right track. What you're imagining is pretty spot on to what... Yes, it's very close quarters. You always have to make sure, like, personal hygiene is, like, paramount, because you're always, like... You're basically within, like, a foot of someone else if you're hanging out down in the crew mess. So as a chef, it presents unique challenges as far as, like, sourcing your ingredients, which is... can be a benefit too. Like when I would go out and just do a quick shopping trip, like to the open air market in France, for example, like those are some pretty neat experiences to get, you know, some awesome ingredients. Or like getting the fresh fish down at the market in like the Bahamas, you know, that was also like, those were like cool aspects of the job. We're like, yes, I'm getting these awesome ingredients. And they're like, they just brought them up from the ground or the ocean, whatever it is. But then stowing them on board, that was the challenge, right? Because you have limited space. We don't have, until you get to the maybe 160 to 200 foot range, you don't really have like walk-in coolers and stuff. So what it really amounts to is that you're working with like a home kitchen facility with some fun toys. But as far as refrigeration, at least in my experience, this is not the same for all yachts. You're just dealing with really limited storage space and especially refrigeration.
Mm-hmm. And how? Oh, yeah. And how many people would you be expecting to feed at each meal? I mean, that could vary from what, 10, 12 to 40? Or I mean, I have no idea. I mean, a yacht. What is a yacht?
So the range I was working on at the super yacht level was about 150 feet. That's where they'd have one chef and typically 6, 7, or 8 other crew members. But then maximum guests would be about 10 to 12 on that size.
Okay.
So daily I was cooking for 20 to 22 people.
Mm-hmm.
5 meals a day, because I'd do breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the guests, lunch and dinner for the crew. Typically, I tried to have some overlap there, right? We use like cooking the same style of food. You know, if I was going to do a Tex-Mex day or like a taco bar for lunch, the whole boat is getting taco bar, you know, to make life easier.
Mm-hmm.
But then dietary restrictions too, you'd find a lot of unique cases there.
Cooking
for pescatarians. I cooked for a oil-free vegan, and that was fun. Different dietary requirements were just can really throw you for a loop, you know.
So once you're out, can you go shopping again, or do you have to, like, I have to plan for this whole voyage and I got to have everything on the boat before I leave?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Wow. So how did you handle the, you know, food storage and all that?
Well, let's see. I've done 2 transatlantic crossings, and on each one, I basically just felt like a squirrel stocking up for the winter. I way overstocked though too. I was working on like 180 footer at that time. So we had like 16 or 18 crew, and I was stocking up in Italy. So what it amounts to is you just go to like every grocery store, and I got like, you know, 100 pounds of potatoes, and like just tucking it into this little Italian car stick shift that I'm trying to drive back to the yacht, you know, these kind of things. So stocking up was definitely a vital aspect of the job, because you realize, seriously, once you get out there, there's no grocery store, there's no nothing. Maybe we could fish, but we were going too fast for trolling. The deck crew did try to fish on the way over every now and again. Best thing you can get is wahoo at 12 to 14 knots. So we did. But yeah, once you're out at sea, I mean, really, the chef is your best hope of getting it. That's what you're working as a crew, right? So my role in life at that point was to make these people happy, but also like keep living, right? Like they can get snacks and stuff. We had plenty of snacks in the crew mess. Like no one was gonna perish from starvation.
Right.
But like as far as preparing the food and the daily, you really had quite the connection there. Just as the engineer, you know, everyone is playing a vital role on this crew. And it typically made a lot of people really close. You'd kind of bond just being in these crazy situations with other crew members from all over the world. And you'd look at each other and be like, oh, this is going on, huh? Like, we rerouted on that trip over from, there was a hurricane in the 1 year. They said, well, weather routing, like with modern technology, it wasn't that big of a deal. But I'm like, are we really sailing like into a hurricane right now? Like, really? You know, we only had a couple of days of bad weather and then it kind of cleared up. We avoided it, you know.
Well, the crew, when you say the crew was doing everything, but sometimes they were helping you in the kitchen, or, you know, were they actually food preparers? Are they swabbing decks too? Or, you know?
Oh, I could finesse the situation. Like being the nice guy in the galley and be like, you know, there was different ways to finesse, like, oh, can you hop on dishes for a little while?
Oh, okay.
Some extra dessert for you, like things like that.
You were nabbing the crew from other duties that they had.
Yeah.
Right.
Definitely.
Oh,
yep.
My gosh.
I was hired on just as, crossing chef, sole chef. There was no expectation for anyone else to go in the galley. And in fact, most chefs would say, like, stay out, please, because, like, I'm busy.
Hands off.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, sounds great. So you have a galley, and that's usually what it is, right? A pretty narrow kitchen,
mm-hmm.
A galley. And then are you below deck, or where are you in relation to where the food is served?
I think with yacht construction these days, most galleys would be on the main deck.
Mm-hmm.
That mostly helps for the provisioning, from what I've seen. Things will be on main deck, and you don't have to run the food up and down stairs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. The last yacht I worked on, most food was all in the main deck, prepared, and then guests typically ate up on the sun deck. So there was some stairs to run. So you had to be careful on plating. A lot of things, chefs like to do tall plates, right? So you'd have, like, just stack everything up, right? And, like, put, like, a little base of mashed potatoes or whatever it is. You stack, make it really tall. Well, when you're on a boat moving at sea, it's very unsteady. So, like, when plating, you have to consider, like, make sure that your server can actually make it to the table with whatever you have. So, one example, this was great. I put a bunch of these really nice microgreens from a farm in the Bahamas. And I was super stoked because you couldn't really get these down there, down island. You know, this is a very specialty ingredient. And I'm like, these beautiful microgreens, they're super tasty. Like, give this, like, little pungent element to the dish. And I was like, I'm actually happy with this. It's not just a garnish. Like, I want them to taste this. Well, on that dish, it went up to the sun deck. The girl said, hey, I'm sorry. They don't really know because every green you put on there just blew off. It just blew off the plate. It's somewhere, like, in the ocean right now. It'll get eaten at some point, you know.
Oh,
yeah. So the garnishes are just flying off the plate. You know, the guests are like trying to eat their glasses of wine or spilling. You know, and, yeah. So
wow, yeah, it is really challenging being on a boat. I mean, stuff is moving, and yeah, kind of like being on a train too. And just, you know, get your sea legs and all that. What are some of the dishes that you did prepare that were just really kind of you loved to go back to, or they were really popular? Give us an idea of, like, a meal you would make.
Oh, shoot. I guess I did quite a few different, because I'm kind of a jack of all trades, mm-hmm. in the kitchen. You know, I didn't really focus on one type. So jack of all trades, master of none, right? But I did everything from Thai to Tex-Mex, curries and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
American and British cuisines. One of the biggest, though, I loved cooking the Spanish tapas style, and we would do little, like, jamon ibérico and manchego cheeses to start, followed by, like, main dish would be, like, paella. So I'd do a large seafood paella with, like, fresh lobster that was brought to the boat, followed by Catalonian flan or something, you know, for dessert.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a pretty typical meal if I decided to go to the Spanish route. And then we would choose the wines based on that, ideally have stocked up on, like, some Tempranillo, Rioja, things like that. So I really like doing the Spanish. French, I didn't do a whole lot of, like, northern France mm-hmm. stuff. We try to keep it a little bit lighter. You know, we're using a lot more, like, olive oil and olive, mm-hmm. sun-dried tomatoes, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
I got to take a break. I have just been enjoying talking with Anthony Horner, and I think we're pretty lucky that he's here in southwestern Wisconsin, but he's talking about his journey of becoming a chef and then serving on yachts in the Caribbean and the Mediterranean. Wow, you can tell that I am just absolutely loving this. Anthony, really, he grew up in Prairie du Chien, and he's been out here for a while. Went to school in Stevens Point, so we really think of him as somebody homegrown here who really had a wonderful opportunity to go abroad and get some training as a chef. And you're listening to Who's in the Kitchen on WDRT 91.9 FM, community radio from the ground up here in Viroqua, Wisconsin, in the southwestern part of the state, part of the Driftless, which encompasses Minnesota and Iowa and a little bit of Illinois, that corner around Mississippi there. And Who's in the Kitchen is on every Saturday at noon. And the last Saturday of the month, we have our farming show, Digging Deep. So you can go to the archives on Who's in the Kitchen and pick up former shows with cooks and chefs and people who love food all around Wisconsin. So thanks for tuning in, and we're going to get back to Anthony. We were just talking about, you know, some of the, he likes to do a lot of kind of cooking, and that's what I'm sure this is why he was recommended for me to have him on the show, because having the challenge of bringing all his expertise and his training into an already existing restaurant, which is Norwegian Hollow Hideaway.
Yep.
Off of Highway 56, west of town, to take a bar and grill that people love, but bring a little bit of je ne sais quoi to the cuisine, get people familiar with maybe some a little broader, you know, menu, and yet still preserve the mood and the ambiance of the place that already exists. It's really a destination. And has been, when did you say it was founded? Like 2006 or something like that?
That's correct. It's founded in 2006.
Yeah. So it's been going for a while. Really pretty little valley in the west of this area. So I just think the idea, I mean, it sounds really romantic to be a chef on a yacht. That just, you know, do you think there are maybe think aspects to that that aren't so romantic? Or what did it really just fulfill all your ideals of, you know, a job?
Well, I will tell you one thing. It was really great. I had like quite a few moments. As a roller coaster has great moments as well. right. But I tell you, there are some reasons why I'm not still working on yachts. And I was looking so hard for a project to take on here in the Driftless. Reason being that the demands on a yacht chef are considerable. Right. So people pay a lot of money to experience a trip on a yacht. So when you have the stakes are a little bit higher. Right. If a guest has a request, like, you are going to fulfill that request any means possible.
Mm-hmm.
I just happened to work on one. We were getting sort of like first-time charterers and a lot of American clientele who were very nice, and we just got some really awesome guests that were super understanding. And like, if I couldn't produce something, like one time I was making pavlova. One of my favorite desserts to make is pavlova.
I don't even know what that is.
It's got a few different names. It's basically a meringue dessert, meringue-based dessert with like whipped cream and fruit at the base, right? And so those three elements will get you pavlova. And I was making it with chickpea juice, the aquafaba, because I was trying to make it vegan. And I just kind of was winging it, and I thought I knew what I was doing. And then I put them in the oven. They all looked beautiful, beautiful meringue, right? Takes about like an hour and a half to bake these things, right? And I looked in the oven, and they had totally, totally collapsed. I was left with just like little wafers, like little sugar syrup wafers. And it was supposed to be a beautiful, fluffy pavlova. And I was like, whoa. Oh. So then I had to go and just do a on-the-fly dessert switch. Thank goodness I had a chocolate brownie like pre-baked like in the freezer. It was like my backup. And I said, hey, guys, like I'm really sorry. They were super stoked for this pavlova. and, you know, said, hey, we're going to make a little change. We're going to go chocolatey tonight instead of fruity. And they were cool about it, you know, but not every yacht guest is going to be cool
like
with that,
say,
right? They will be like kind of freaking out.
They've paid good money.
Right.
And they want what was on the menu.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Hey, just a little segue. I'm really interested in the chickpea juice. I just read that you can make your homemade mayonnaise out of chickpea juice and oil and beat it up like you make a homemade mayonnaise without an egg. Without an egg, right? Is that true? Have you done that?
Yeah, definitely. It's
so you are making a meringue out of chickpea juice? Tell me how you do that. Same thing.
It functions basically the same
as
egg white. I realized actually my mistake on that one is to reduce the chickpea liquid because I had used pre-canned. And for that to make it actually stronger and it'll like, I don't know if it emulsify. It'll just whip up better when it's reduced. You have a thicker chickpea liquid.
The reducing is you actually cook it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Simmer it down.
You're going to simmer that down. To get the strongest aquafaba you want, it really just... I would recommend just take the juice of like 2 cans of chickpeas, reduce it by about, I would say like half. So you get back to like one can's worth.
Pretty thick.
And then chill that and it'll basically whip up just like an egg. So yeah, I haven't heard of the mayonnaise thing, but I have high hopes that would work.
Probably would be good. A little lemon juice and then you've got, mm-hmm. I'm an Orthodox Christian and we're keeping the Lenten fast all over the world by not any meat or dairy for you know, the whole of Lent. So, you know, a good part of my life is vegan just because of church fasts. And so I've gotten more interested in the whole vegan, you know. It's really handy because now vegan is very common and there's lots of things, lots of substitutes and lots of things that you can do that maybe 20 years ago weren't really around. It's mm-hmm. not much of a sacrifice now. Oh, I, you know, just let them eat this, you know, instead. But anyway, I just saw that recipe, and I was at a friend's house, and they said, oh, yeah, we make it all the time. And I go, wow, I never heard of mayonnaise made with chickpea. And it doesn't, I mean, you can make something sweet with it. It doesn't have a chickpea flavor. When you make your meringue, does it have any residual, or is it very neutral?
Oh, what I noticed is... it'll have like a little bit of a nutty flavor.
Uh-huh. Oh, but that's all.
Nutty, and then it'll brown up. So if you're looking for a really nice, bright white meringue, you probably won't get it. It'll be a little bit more...
caramelly color.
Yeah, like caramel color.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. Well, I bet desserts is one of the things you could go with at the Hideaway. I mean, just keeping your same menu, but then have some really smashing desserts that nobody has ever tasted out here, ever. Do you do desserts there? Do people even look for desserts when they go to a bar?
Well, yeah, we've got a little ice cream sundae on the menu and a New York-style cheesecake. So I went with those two because you can really gussy them up in any way, right? So we can have what fresh fruit we want to use or berry compote, whatever it might be. You can take those two elements and sort of change them up on a weekly. But so far, desserts have been not very popular, even with those two. I thought about putting something more advanced and unique on the menu because those are very basic, right? Most people mm-hmm. can get ice cream at home. Or you can get, you know, cheesecake mm-hmm. is pretty common. So, but that was... just a start, right?
Yeah.
So,
because
it takes people a while to know that, like, you're going to the same place that you have been for years and years and years, and then like, even you realize, oh, there's dessert on the menu. Like, it's a slow change. Like, it's on the menu, but like not being ordered very often. It's kind of fun, but I think it's nice to have a little sweet treat at the end of the meal. You know, either that or like an after dinner drink or something.
Uh-huh. Well, it is a lovely drive. You see a lot of motorcycles heading out for the Hideaway. Just, you know, if you're a cyclist, as my husband and I is, you know, you're looking for, you know, places to stop in. And if you knew at the end of the evening, you'd go for a really fancy dessert down at the Hideaway. I think that would be really fun. So let's see. How many years did you serve on yachts? How old are you?
I worked. I'm 33 years old now. My birthday was April 7th.
So
just turned 33.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
How did you do this for years? work on yachts?
Honestly, yeah. I mean, that's the majority of my culinary career, actually. Because yachts were something related to yachts. So even when I did culinary's little program over in Thailand, I did a one-week intensive program in Thailand. I mean, that was purely so I could get the skills that people wanted, right? Thai was, it's very trending. A lot of folks like that.
What would you say is kind of typical of Thai, say as opposed to any other Asian dishes or Indian? There's a kind of combination of Asian and Indian. It's, you know, those crossovers of spices and things like that. But what really characterizes Thai?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say the shrimp paste, fish sauce, cilantro, chili. They really play with the like five flavor sweets, you know, sweet, salty, bitter, umami, and spicy. So they're really playing with all those characteristics. But I think as soon as you add fish sauce and lime juice to it, you get a kind of a Thai boost. But then they have a rich culinary history too, because, you know, the Silk Road by Sea was what Silk Road by Land did influence the Thai curries. So Thai green curry is very, very Thai. But then Thai Massaman curry is actually more influenced by your Indian spices. So that's one that's a real blend of those flavors, where they've taken more cumin, coriander, paprika, those spices, added it to the Massaman curry. So it's more of a blend between Thai and Indian.
Mm-hmm. So what makes a curry? It's not necessarily, pulse or you know, beans or peas or something like that. It could be, but it also meat. Also meat is in a curry, right? Is a curry a sauce? Or is it a soup? Or what's a curry? Or just a combination of spices?
I think it's a pretty broad culinary term for basically at the end of the day you probably call it a spiced stew or something. Don't let them know
right that. So the spices are really important to it. I mean,
spices
that's
are
it.
very
yeah.
important, because the world of curry is basically infinite. They've got a million. I do like the most basics of basic, you know, like a butter chicken or something, you know, tikka masala. But like honestly, once you start adding in those spices and start simmering, and the world is pretty vast. It's actually, I'm looking forward to learning more someday about it.
Yeah, well, I guess Americans have, you know, fairly recently discovered Thai and Vietnamese and things like that, and love, you know, finding a restaurant like that and getting to, you know, sample those wonderful tastes. And my husband was an Indian musician. And his instruments are on display at Parish Music, if you want to go down and see. He played the sitar, and that was his main instrument, but he played the dalruba and the veena, and what else did he play? Anyway, he hung around with the Indian Music Circle in Chicago for years. So they did a lot of Indian cooking. He was very interested in that, a lot of potlucks, and learned how to do Indian cooking. So that was one of his main culinary ventures. But then we got interested in Thai and other things. So our refrigerator is just jam-packed with spices, awesome. Condiments.
That's great. Some fun ones, right? Yeah, some chutneys. And,
yes, and he made us some wonderful chutney out of eggplants we grew 1 year, and I still got some of it. It's black, just black, made with, spiced eggplant chutney.
Wow, I bet you that's very flavorful.
Aging just makes it better.
Sure. Yeah.
So now, when did you come to, you know, actually buying a restaurant? I mean, that was a big thing. You've been looking for a while for something in Wisconsin.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once I realized that being a yacht chef wasn't sustainable, at least for me, realized that I was heading towards a really fast track towards like a serious burnout. So I was looking, and found Norwegian Hollow Hideaway for sale. It did take quite a while to really get my ducks in a row to make that happen, you know, and quite a big decision. And I mean, I do love Wisconsin and my friends and family here, and but as far as tying myself down like that, I wasn't sure, you know, being a traveling chef for so long, you know, but that was my main goal, is kind of like tired of traveling full time, you know, and just always at someone else's beck and call, you know, like constantly, and the stress of it, you know. Mm-hmm. So now the stressors are different, and it is from what I've seen, it's been since September 12th, 2024, when the transition took place. And it has been really rewarding, like especially now coming out of the winter season.
Yeah.
We've had time to like develop the program and like take business practices to the next level. You know, we're able to accept credit cards now. We're able to like, you know, get our inventory in a row and menu planning. And that's how we're able to actually put out some of these dishes, you know, different things that people are willing to try.
Great. And you must find this area wonderful for sourcing local foods. I mean, from meats and charcuterie and cheeses. And are you able to take advantage of that? And will you find your clientele interested in that direction?
Honestly, being in the Midwest, especially Wisconsin here in the Southwest corner, it's like being a kid in a candy shop. I mean, just the other day, like I bartered for a bag of wild rice. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'll get 20 pounds of hand-harvested wild rice from northern Wisconsin, you know? That's not going to happen though anywhere else, right? Like, well, for somewhere that grows wild rice. So that was just one ingredient, right? So sourcing these ingredients locally, we've got some of the world's best sheep cheese, like coming out of Westby. Like, I tried some the other day, a blue cheese, a hard cheese, and it's like, this is giving whatever they're putting out in France like a run for their money. Like, we have way better cheese. We have better cheese, happier cows. Like, everything down here is, it's really beautiful. It's amazing as a chef to be working here in the Driftless.
Yeah, you can get grass-fed beef and, you know, all kinds of, yeah, the pastured pork and chickens and things like that. So, I mean, I say that since I've been doing Who's in the Kitchen, which is about 15 years, I feel like I just hit the jackpot as far as the food. I mean, the last 15 years in Wisconsin, we've gone for, like, you know, cabbages and potatoes in the grocery store to, you know, amazing array of foods in the groceries. I mean, nobody ever heard of cilantro. No one would have ever asked, or if they'd gone through the aisle, nobody would have known what it was or how to fix it or anything. And, you know, we've got a lot of Hispanic people in this area, so our Hispanic repertoire has just really, really grown and in the grocery stores. And just, you know, people are interested in getting fresh fruits and vegetables and local. And we have so many Amish that now have greenhouses that can grow greens almost all winter long. And we have arugula and spinach and mixed salad greens, and, you know, just fresh picked out of the greenhouse. So many things available to us right here in the Midwest. And I suppose what we're really missing is the seafood. That is one thing, you know. But you can get local fish. And I like to get my fish from Alaska. They ship that down, you know. Now we have frozen, you know, freezer trucks and everything that can bring things down, and you can buy things frozen. And so, but we have so many pastured, organic, all kinds of meats, and it's just eggs. Great place to be able to buy stuff. And so, yeah, it's probably like a kid in a candy shop.
Yeah, there's a world of opportunity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of locally grown, really different things popping up, like you said, in the past and relatively recently, of getting a bigger variety of what's going mm-hmm. on at the markets and stuff.
Yeah. I'm talking to Anthony Horner. I think he's just sounds like a wonderful asset to our community. He is the owner chef of Norwegian Hollow Hideaway, a little bar and grill west of town here, out in the country. Nice little drive. And he had a wonderful training and got to go to southern France and train and then work on yachts as a chef, kind of personal chef. And he has just pretty recently, I didn't realize how recently you had taken over. It's really, this is your first summer, really. It's going to be your first real, you know, season.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to going into the summer season. Yeah, it's definitely going to be busy.
That will really, really be fun. And so we've just been, you know, talking about the history and how he's been influenced. And I guess maybe it's kind of silly to say who are your favorite chefs or favorite cookbooks, but do you have sort of a direction, or are you just like really diverse? Sounds like you're just incredibly diverse.
Well, right. I do have my specialties, of course, and there's been I've had influence over the years of different chefs. For example, Jose Andres is a pretty well-known Spanish chef. Mm-hmm. He's got multiple restaurants now, and he got his credentials from El Bulli in Spain. Mm-hmm. I worked at a restaurant of his down in Miami. That was a different situation. That's where I had the influence in the Spanish tapas, because I was working at a restaurant down in Miami. It's not there anymore, but they have other of it. But Chef Jose Andres is really an inspiration. He's also who founded the World Central Kitchen.
That's what I thought. That's and where I know his name.
That to me
from.
Is especially inspiring, right? I do want to use my skill set in a way that he is, where he's managed to really feed a number of people. And I think that is really inspiring, right?
Incredible humanitarian effort that he has done since. When did this really pop up with the Ukrainian war? Was it before that? I know he's fed, you know, well, he goes into places where people are really stranded without food and is, yeah.
Exactly.
Thousands.
I'm sure
beating
there's
thousands.
Been aid going from World Central Kitchen to the Ukraine and to Israel. Their very first, I think, was the way it got started was Chef Andres was basically fed up by how long it was taking FEMA to get anywhere. And so there was the large disaster. He was able to just basically send the trucks, send them down, tons and tons of food. He said, make sure you use a lot of aioli on these sandwiches. Because these people, they don't have running clean water right now, so they need something to get it down. So there's extra mayo on the sandwiches, you know, things you might not really think about, but
moisture.
If you don't have water,
uh-huh.
Right?
Oh.
So make your sandwiches extra tasty, because you can get them down. But so no, he's done a lot of relief effort, and I think that's really great, you know, to use your talents for good like that.
Mm-hmm.
Grant Achatz is another huge inspiration to me.
How do you spell his last name?
Achatz.
Oh, I wouldn't have come up with that.
Right.
Where
so Grant
he from?
Achatz he's a Michelin starred chef in based out of Chicago now. He's, one restaurant very very popular is called Alina. You can see more about him on like Mind of a Chef on Netflix, and there's quite a bit of documentation on what they're doing. And that's more of the inspiration there is more the creative aspect in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
where he was doing things that you would have never seen before, like actual culinary inventions, right? Like he had a blown sugar piece that was filled with helium so that the dish that was going out was actually floating on an edible helium balloon. Those are the kind of things he's doing in his restaurant, right? So those are things that are way out of my league. And by the way, you don't ask me if you're going to see that at Norwegian Hollow Hideaway. I can't really make any guarantees on edible helium balloons. But,
the sky's the limit, though.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's amazing. Exactly. Well, I would like to talk to you a little bit about baking the side, because you got to have training in pastry and bread and all that stuff. So talk to us a little bit about what is a pastry as apart from bread? What's a pastry? Is a pastry more, I think of it as like more oil or butter oriented, is like the basis, but I don't even really know.
Well, I guess,
I mean, it's not the same as like yeast and a rising bread.
It's true. Know? They are two different specializations.
Yeah.
Pastry, the base is pâtisserie, and the base word pâte, meaning paste. These guys are making different pastes that kind of... This is in my head. I don't know if there's any grounds to this or not. But you're working with just lots of things that don't actually look like what they are. Right? When you're making a cake or something, you're dealing with batters. That's what batter is a better word than paste.
Oh, okay.
So you're working with batters as opposed to doughs. So working as a baker, you're working with dough versus working with batter, I guess. is kind of the way I saw it. Obviously, when you look at the world of pastry, baking, viennoiserie, those are just different specializations in all these things in the world.
So can you just give us some directions about making something, maybe some kind of pastry that you like to do and isn't too hard, just for our home cooks? What are kind of pastries that you have made? Well, you did your meringue, which isn't really a pastry at all. But do you do something that's flaky? Do you do a viennoise? Do you do what?
Oh, for that kind of thing? I mean, yeah, I'm not going to do a puff pastry from scratch. I do know somewhere in the area that you can.
Really?
You have the best croissants in the area, and I am sure they are homemade, is the St. Francis Hermitage outside of Gaze
Right. Mills. We are enjoying that place.
Oh, my gosh. I went down there and was speaking with the nuns. They're all really, you know, beautiful people. And I'm sure they're homemade. They're the best in the area.
Right,
so worth it to go out there and grab a croissant and a pastry there. It's at least it's grab and go, you know. And
that's the place to go if you want to just go look at a glass case with most gorgeous pastries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just really fun. And they themselves grow organic pork, organic chickens. I like to go there and get their meat. I know everything is, you know, beautifully raised. I would go and get I get crepes. I like going there in the morning to get crepes. They have really good crepes. And then they'll always have a little salad. And one time they just had just run out to the garden and gotten the greens right out of the garden put on the plate. I mean, so do you have a garden adjacent to your restaurant? Or do you just source your things from markets and things?
Yeah, there's a garden out there. The plot was already dug up, fenced off, and producing when I bought the restaurant. So that was pretty awesome to rock out there and grab some tomatoes. We had tomatoes, green beans, peppers were all going. So the former owner kind of offered to share it with me. He said, yeah, go ahead and take some. So I did. Tomatoes and that. So I'm looking forward to expanding the garden, at least getting it planted this year in order to get some of those fresh products. But I want to do that, you know, as a personal mission. I like gardening too, you know, and growing some things.
I'm sure.
But honestly, I will leave the majority of vegetable growing production to the other local farmers, area farmers who do it much better than I. You know? I will not rely on my garden to feed the community this summer, but.
And thank goodness there are people that are doing it. We just interviewed a small family farm a couple of weeks ago, and oh my gosh, they grew 6 acres of fruits and vegetables. You know, that's a lot of food. I mean, that's a lot of workers. Yeah. So, but you know, you can get that food from the farmer's market, or you know, they have their CSAs, and you can get subscriptions to that too. So I'm sure having a garden is a whole other effort besides a restaurant going. But anyway, you got out of actually telling me about a pastry and went to the Hermitage. But what have I tried to do? I've never really gotten too far into that because I don't really go for sweets so much anymore. I really love French bread and stuff. Yeah. And you can bake bread, but I bet you don't do that much in the restaurant. Do you bake your own bread?
Yes, some of that. We're doing what we can. You know, obviously there's a lot of prep work involved, and with the facility, we don't have a full bakery, right? But we're doing like little garlic cheddar biscuits to put with a fish fry, and then homemade rolls, dinner rolls for the Saturday. So two different breads. But as far as brioche buns, I am not making those from scratch. But that also keeps the price point where I want it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Without going into numbers, it's just trying to make it as affordable as possible.
Yeah,
so you can come down there and hang out, you know, multiple times, right? And not break the bank. So I want the quality quality, quantity, I guess. I need that relationship to be strong.
That's great. So I think that's a recipe for success. Mm-hmm. I have seen some ethnic restaurants that have moved here that have gradually become more and more white and less spicy and less, you know, different just because of the, you know, the local population and what they, you know, what they'll buy. And so you kind of have to be realistic. I mean, who are your clientele and what do they want? So if you you can have a special, night special and that kind of thing and expand people's taste a little bit, but it's good to be realistic. Who's your main clientele?
I was lucky enough to see that the existing clientele was like really amazing. And that's kind of, I knew what I was getting into and I had already had some experience in a bar down in Case Mills. And I knew that people are really willing to try new things. So that's where my goal was to just sort of refine the menu just a little bit, right? Nothing's broken. It's pretty solid. And then add on whatever it is for specials because there's a lower risk involved in just running a special, right? So we've done a few things already, a couple of different pastas and stuff like that that have been very popular. And really, folks are really, really amazing. Everyone who's coming down there, we've had a lot of great guest experiences. People are super stoked to see the place continue on, you know?
I know. We'd hate to see that drift away. And so it's good that you're wanting to do that. So, gosh, the hour has gone by awfully quickly. I'm Philothea Beeson. I've been talking with Anthony Horner, and he is the owner chef of Norwegian Hollow Hideaway, which many of you have probably been down to over the years, and he's the new chef there. And so it's just been fun hearing about his history and background, which is terrific, and I'm just hoping that he'll stay here for a while. And you've been listening to Who's in the Kitchen on WDRT 91.9 FM, streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can listen to this and other previous shows that we have done, and also go to Digging Deep, our monthly show on farming. So thank you so much for tuning in and being loyal to this show. I really appreciate it. And we'll be back again next week.